Danway FM presents.
Welcome to China Business Cast. I'm your host, Robert Ness. This podcast is kicking off a series on entrepreneurship in China. And our first entrepreneur is Fritz Damopolo. He is the CEO of Chunar.com and a serial Sinopreneur. So let's listen to Fritz. Let's think about entrepreneurship in China. And anybody out there who's interested in entrepreneurship in China, if you want to start your own business, you know, come to China and do your own thing, or you want to build the next Chunar or Baidu, NetEase, Sina, whatever, send me an email at robert@danway.org. This especially goes out to all you techies out there. Your interaction will help us bring you better entrepreneurship-related content in the future and even serve as an intermediary for meeting other like-minded, China-focused entrepreneurs. Okay, let's get started. Okay, let's start by talking about your experiences at Xiaowei and NetEase.
My experiences at Xiaowei and NetEase, I guess I've been an entrepreneur and an advisor and an employee in China for a number of years. And as an entrepreneur, I started Xiaowei in 1999 with a couple other guys, which is a sports website. And, you know, like a lot of people, you know, we had a great business plan and we raised some money and we grew that business and we were fortunate to sell it. And I think what was interesting, I think, is about Xiaowei is, although, you know, like a sports website sounds like a pretty tame business model. I mean, we were one of the first to do it in this market, and being the first to do a lot of things, frankly. We were the first company to work with Reuters News Agency. We were the first company to hire proper journalists. We were the first company not to pirate anybody, stuff like that. And I think that led to some success, you know, in building that business.
For Xiaowei, what was the life cycle like? Well, first of all, how did you raise money if you were the first one doing it? I mean, how were you able to get that kind of trust from investors?
There was a few things that we did. First of all, we had to put up some of our own money. We had to quit our expat jobs. And so putting up your own money and quitting your expat job really shows a lot of commitment that, you know, that you really believe in the project. And I think that probably applies anywhere in the world, and it also applies in China. And, you know, we were lucky. Timing was on our side. Where at that time there was a huge interest in Chinese internet opportunities. I mean, it was around the same time of the China.com IPO. In fact, we had launched our website, I think, a few months prior to their IPO, and so that, you know, coincided with a huge amount of investor interest. I guess you could say that was the Web 1.0 interest in China. So timing certainly helped us. But besides that, obviously, as I mentioned, commitment, you know, we built a company, you know, we set up an office, we hired some people, so we were really moving. And so in a way, you have to gamble, and gambling means you have to put some money down, and you have to, it's almost like a train, you have to start moving in a direction towards a ravine, not knowing if there's going to be a bridge there or not. And if the investors come in, all of a sudden you have a bridge that can carry you over that ravine and continue to grow your business.
And then you worked with NetEase, and that was you worked with that company. You didn't start that company, obviously, but you. Right. What's it like working for a web company instead of starting one?
Yeah, I was hired to work at NetEase after Xiaowei, and NetEase was at that time a substantially larger company than the company that I had founded and sold. And on one hand, having been an entrepreneur, and NetEase is very much an entrepreneurial company, there was a seamless transition. You could say, you know, utilizing both my experience as an entrepreneur, but also maybe, you know, some ideas just, you know, having come from the United States, as well as, you know, being a media guy. I mean, you know, I'm a media guy, as well as an internet entrepreneur. And so, you know, utilizing those skills and capabilities, and, you know, NetEase and Sina and Sohu and some of these other internet companies, you know, these are some of the biggest media companies in China, really, if you think about it in terms of their reach among people and their influence on people. And so, you know, I guess my skills and abilities and background, both as a media executive at News Corporation as well as a, an entrepreneur, just fit pretty well with that company.
Now you said Xiaowei was Web 1.0 in China. Now, so we have this thing now that everyone's calling Web 2.0. What kind of opportunities does that hold in the Chinese context?
Well, first of all, I'm a little bit confused exactly what Web 2.0 is. However, you know, my current company, we certainly utilize elements of Web 2.0 into our business just because, you know, it really makes sense. But, you know, let's bear in mind that one of the first things that we must do as entrepreneurs is, you know, think about the fundamentals of business, which is products and markets. You know, finding good markets where we can make some money and developing good products and services that meet customer needs. And some of these Web 2.0 applications, you know, fit right in. Specifically to China, we feel that Web 2.0 is pretty exciting for a couple of reasons. We feel that Chinese consumers are very expressive, and Web 2.0 technologies and applications just make it really, really easy to publish stuff online, right, and share it with a lot of different people, and communicate with a lot of different people in very innovative ways that we haven't done, that wasn't possible before. And the fact that China is growing, and as any emerging affluent society, people are a little bit more individual, they have different tastes, they're more discriminating about what they do. Just walking on the street, for example, you can see people wearing different colored clothes or different styles and fashions and stuff like that. You know, that's just on a very simple level, but it's of course much more complicated than that. And you know, Web 2.0, you know, blogs and you know, podcasts and social networking and vertical search engines and all that junk together is really conducive for, I guess you can say, an emerging, expressive society, really. And so we're seeing maybe a bigger boom here in the use of Web 2.0 than we are in other markets, because this is the first time that a large number of people can really express themselves. Whereas in other parts of the world, they've been doing it for years, right? I mean, in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, I mean, we're sick of that in the U.S., to be honest. And you know, maybe here, like, it's only starting.
So you're saying Web 2.0 is helping Chinese express themselves when they couldn't do it before. What other ways can we look to understand the Chinese internet market in particular? How can we characterize them in a way that separates them from other markets?
Well, I think that's a good question. It's always good to know, you know, what are the differences, right? But, you know, first of all, you know, let's remind ourselves, you know, what are the similarities? And I talked about this earlier, you know, what are the fundamentals of business? Well, one of those fundamentals is just, you know, market segmentation. And what does that mean? It says, okay, how are we going to divide up the market? Is it gender? Is it age? Is it income level? Education? You know, whatever it is, and that applies in China just as much as it applies everywhere else. And you know, people want the same things in the world, really. I mean, if you think about it, like, they want to get up in the morning. You know, they want to eat breakfast. You know, they want to work. They want to hang out. You know, they want to watch movies, or they want to be entertained, and they want to go on vacation and raise their kids and have a stable future. And if you think about it, you know, that's pretty similar everywhere in the world. And of course, there's a lot of quirks in how they make decisions and their tastes and all that sort of stuff that might be different. But there's certainly a lot of similarities. And you know, let's not forget that. You know, let's not. You know, I mean, you know, this is not rocket science. It's just that, you know, sometimes with China, you know, people throw everything out the window. Oh, it's China, it must be different. So we have to forget about every rule and every principle that we've learned or we've utilized in other markets. That's the first thing that I think it's important. But yes, you know, there certainly are some differences. There's a lot more, I mean, obviously, there's a lot more young people who use the internet. The internet is the first commercial media for most people in China. And what I mean by that is, in North America, people are used to commercial television, commercial print, radio, all that sort of stuff, which means that it's, you could argue, it's maybe a little bit market-driven, it's biased for commercial reasons as opposed to legal and or regulatory reasons. You know, just more market driven in say markets such as in North America. Now in China, media in general has been very, very regulated. And the internet was the first deregulated or semi-deregulated media. So what does that mean? It means that consumers certainly are more open and receptive to that, and that's really changed their mindset. Meaning in the mind of a consumer, when like you think of what's really relevant to you, as it's really going to be internet media properties. In North America, when you ask yourself that same question, it could be, I don't know, the Wall Street Journal, it could be the New York Times, it could be the New Yorker Magazine, maybe it's Fox News or something like that, I don't know. Or maybe, you know, maybe some commercial radio stations, whatever it is. So it's just these relative differences in the market and how they've developed really influence consumer perceptions and, you know, what's important to them.
One perception that a lot of us foreigners have about the internet in China, and indeed all forms of media in China, is government regulation. And can you talk a bit about that? And how does it manifest itself in the internet as opposed to other forms of media in China?
Well, certainly, certain aspects of media are very much regulated. And I guess you could say in traditional media, distribution is completely regulated and completely controlled. But to be honest, just like it is in many other markets in the world, too. And then on the content side, it's a little bit less regulated when it comes to everything but news. And on the internet, distribution and content is less regulated, meaning you can have your own distribution platform, like seen as a distribution platform if you think about it. And it also, you know, produces some content or it actually works with other partners to offer content. Yeah.
CNET is the...
CNET.com, which is... the largest and most influential internet company in China, you could argue. So I guess, in terms of regulations on the internet, you know, let's remember that the government has multiple objectives for the public. One objective is to encourage economic development. A second objective and a subsection of that would be to encourage technological development and to make China a modern, information-savvy country. And as such, the government would like to encourage the development of information technology, including the internet. That, of course, has a positive influence on us. As entrepreneurs or as established internet companies, because the government certainly favors what we're doing on that level. And there's certainly, you know, some, you know, regulatory quirks and issues that, you know, we all have to deal with on top of that, as I guess any industry anywhere, really.
Is there a conflict there between trying to encourage technological development and trying to control content that you don't want?
Well, because we're in the travel business, it really doesn't apply to us. But I would suspect that, you know, some of these other businesses, you know, I mean, everyone needs to be smart, right? I mean, we all need to follow government policy, and we need to be smart about it.
Okay, so talk a bit about Qunar.
So Qunar, or Qunar in Mandarin, which means where are you going, is a vertical search engine focused on the travel category. And what we do is we compare prices for flights and hotels to help consumers make better informed choices about where they want to go. And we started our company about 18 months ago, and we've grown to be the third largest travel site in China and one of the largest vertical search engines in the world, really.
Now, when people think of search engines, maybe they think of Google or Yahoo. What is a vertical search engine? This is a new technology emerging in search technology. Can you talk a bit about that?
A vertical search engine essentially focuses on one area. You have vertical search engines for video, for images, for blogs, other e-commerce categories, and travel. And so all we do is we say we just want to, and a search engine is all about providing relevant information to consumers, meeting their information requirements. And if we solely focus on one category, in this case travel, we think we can do a pretty good job at it and possibly a better job than the general search engines.
How did you come upon this opportunity?
It was pretty simple. About 2 years ago, in the midst of the Google hype, we very quickly realized that 20% of Google's revenues came from travel-related advertising. And we also know that 40% of all e-commerce transactions are actually travel-related, buying tickets, booking car rental, stuff like that. So we thought, well, wait a minute. Is there a way to focus just on that category and do a little bit better job and maybe take our fair share or more than our fair share of revenues? So basically, that's all it was. Google is super big, and a super big part of Google is travel. And so can we focus on that area and maybe do it like a better job and make some money out of it?
Now, your experience is you have a lot of experience working in China with the web. Is that the only reason you chose to target the Chinese market with Kunar?
Well, China is the second most important internet market in the world after the United States. I mean, hands down. And number three, it's kind of hard to tell. Is it Japan? Maybe. Is it some other market? Maybe. I don't know. So because of our relationships and our experience in China, we could certainly be number one in China. So that's great. So our initial strategy has been to focus on China. But keep in mind that we have a deal in Japan as well as in Hong Kong, and we have an English site. So we're not limiting ourselves to China, but we're using China as our springboard into other markets around the world.
Tell me a bit about your entrepreneurial experience in China and the difficulties and issues you run up against and how do you solve them?
As entrepreneurs, we need to be flexible, we need to be creative, we need to know how to solve problems very quickly and very efficiently. And to be honest, we need to be willing to make some bets. We may not know everything about every discipline, but we need to be pretty smart about those bets that we make. And sometimes we make mistakes, but that's no big deal. Just as long as we don't make it twice. That applies in China as it does everywhere else. In China, however, the rate of change is very significant. Jim McGregor once said that China is both a startup and a turnaround story all at the same time. Meaning it's like a big established company that's trying to turn itself around, and at the same time it's a startup trying to grow and really, really grow fast. And so we're in the midst of that. And that means the cycles in China are much more pronounced. The ups and downs are more pronounced. People are incredibly ambitious. In some ways they're not very patient. It's almost like they're taking a playbook out of American culture or kind of the McDonald's culture, people want it and they want it now and they don't want to wait. And so we have to deal with all that sort of stuff. The legal and regulatory environment is changing every single day. Policy is being promulgated at the same time as companies and entrepreneurs are trying to follow those policies. And which is, of course, a huge opportunity because on one hand, we can influence the development of those policies. On the other hand, we better make sure that we follow policies that at first may be contradictory or uncertain. The consumer market, of course, is emerging. And again, we have to be smart about, we have to make certain bets. How is that market emerging? We have to go back to the fundamentals of business. Tastes are changing. Consumers are becoming more discriminating. There's more niche marketing opportunities. People are demanding, high quality, good value products, just like everywhere in the world. But we have to see, where have consumers come from? What's their collective experience, and try to kind of adapt to those expectations moving forward.
What about in terms of running the company, and what kind of challenges often emerge in that context?
In China, relationships are extremely important. In fact, you could say maybe even more important than in other markets. And it makes sense. In an environment that's very unstable and changing very quickly, what can you rely upon? Well, you can rely upon your relationships. because you can't rely upon laws that are constantly changing or being changed as we speak, and businesses are growing and changing and all that sort of stuff. So therefore, relationships are really, really important. So what does that mean as a entrepreneur, as a manager of a business? Well, that means that your relationship with your employees is probably more important than some of the economic issues. If people feel like they're going to learn from you, if they can trust you, if they believe in your vision, they're probably going to give up their short-term economic interest to follow you. That's great. Does it happen in other markets? Yeah, but it's less pronounced. So we think that's a huge benefit, or say that's just, it makes it really easy to start business in China. Of course, at the same time, you have to deliver, and if you don't deliver on those promises, or if you don't deliver on that vision, people are willing to change really, really quickly because maybe that relationship has dissipated. And so it's good and bad. You know, you can catch a massive wave, but that wave can make you, you know, I guess hit the coral pretty hard.
You mentioned as an entrepreneur in China, you have to make a lot of bets and you have to make a lot of mistakes too. Can you give me an example of a huge bet you made and also a mistake you made?
That's a good question. A bet might be the name of your company. When we started Sha Wei, my sports website, which means brave shark in Mandarin, I mean, you know, it has nothing to do with sports. It wasn't called Sports Line or Entertainment and Sports Programming Network. ESPN. There was a ton of there's a ton of sites called chinasports.com, sportschina.com, cnsports.com, sportscn.com, just a zillion sites, all like that. And we thought, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe we need to do something that's a little bit different. So it was a bet, and all of my local colleagues thought I was crazy and it was a really stupid idea, but we just had to ignore their advice. We had to make a bet, say, you know, there's a principle that tells me you have to be different, and I'm going to stick to it. And in the end, it was a great name. Everybody remembered it. It was a great brand. So that was a great bet, and it worked. And, you know, we've made other bets along the way that maybe haven't worked as well. Like earlier in the year, like we had hired a guy who was a journalist who we thought could lead our marketing team, and he had some pretty good relationships, but you know, everybody knows that like a journalist can't be head of marketing, but so we took a bet that maybe he could really do a good job, and you know, it didn't quite work out the way we wanted it to, so we had to eventually bring in somebody else. So for example, we take a bet, like every principal told us that like a journalist never makes a good marketing director, but you know, it could, but maybe in this case it would be different, and it didn't quite work out.
Why did you think it'd be different in that case?
Yeah, we thought he had some pretty good relationships. He had some pretty good ideas, and to be honest, we also trusted him. So I guess it was all those things together.
Is it a Chinese journalist or a foreigner?
Yeah, I'm the only foreigner in the company. Yeah.
Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.
Cool.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. Please send us recommendations on who else we can interview. Send them to me at robert@danway.org. Leave comments and feedback to me in my email or on the Danway blog. Okay, that's it for this episode of China Business Cast. I'm your host, Robert Ness, and I'm coming to you through Danway FM. Thank you, and until next time.